Welcome to the Gottesdienst Crowd, where we foster confessional integrity, liturgical preservation, and preaching that doesn't stink. We believe that the historic liturgy of the divine service is more than mere cobwebs of antiquity, but it is a true treasure of the church to be dusted off and brought down from her attic to be enjoyed. So let's get dusting. Welcome back to the Gottesdienst Crowd. This is Jason Broughton, your host. Today we have with us back again, Anthony Dodgers. He is the pastor of Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Charlotte, Iowa, and a blogger for the Gottesdienst blog. Welcome back, Anthony.
Hi, great to be back.
Well, it's good to have you. And it's sort of fortuitous that we decided to do this topic this month, because April is National Poetry Month. Did you know that?
No, I didn't even know that.
Yeah. So I've already given it away, we're going to take up some time today to discuss poetry and the role of poetry, not only for the theologian, but also for just the human being. So before we actually look at some poems that will go along with the celebrations and meditations during Holy Week, why poetry? What does poetry do? How does it help the theologian? And how does it even serve man in general?
I think that's a great question, because a lot of people can seem to, they're a little scared by poetry, maybe.
I think that's the best description. I think they're just scared of it. It's something they're unfamiliar with.
Yeah, it's so much different from how we normally talk and even how we normally read something like a news article or a novel or anything that's very linear. Poetry has a different, it goes about its subject entirely differently. So the way I like to think about it is that poetry is unique in how it helps us to see the world from a different perspective. It sort of highlights a particular thing, or it exaggerates something to really magnify it and call it more to our attention. This could be anything. You know, there's poems about all different kinds of subjects. You could have one of my favorites is, you know, a poem about a scene by Robert Frost, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. So there's a scene that he is mulling around and picking up his subject and seeing how it can express something new to him that he hadn't noticed before. I think poetry often does something that can catch us off guard. So even if you have seen this kind of a scene or this subject before, it might surprise you. Or even if you've never personally experienced what the poem is talking about, it can help you to gain that experience yourself. Poetry also, in its attempt to kind of really delve into something and mull it over and sort of dwell on it for a while, poetry will make a lot of use of metaphors, you know, painting kinds of different images to also help you give a new perspective. And that can be difficult at first to people if they're not used to it. I think in that way, poetry is very similar to the parables of Jesus. And, you know, sometimes people, they read a parable too, and they think, well, I don't know what that means, you know, and they don't quite know where to start, how to pick it apart and really start to deal with it.
Yeah, poetry, kind of in my mind, is words that uses or makes use of all of the senses, you know, mm-hmm. that it's not just something that you read or even hear, but it's something that evokes or makes use of every sense that we have by tapping into our memory of, like you said, Robert Frost's scene of, you know, being on a road in a snowy wood, or other such things that we can actually see in our mind's eye, or smell in our mind's nose, or feel in our mind's hands, things like that. It incorporates not just the mind, but the whole person. It's almost as if it incorporates both body and soul, right? It's not just an intellectual exercise.
Yeah, I agree with that completely.
And it seems to express what ordinary language just simply can't get at, right? It's seeking to say something in such a way that just saying it straightforwardly does not have the impact or the meaning.
Yeah, I agree. Maybe even to use a metaphor or analogy, it's like, you know, you can have food that provides nourishment that doesn't really have any flavor, and then you can have food that also provides nourishment, but that is just delicious, you know, and has so much different, so many different subtleties in its flavor. That poetry is sort of the flavor, rather than just saying it straightforwardly and sort of matter-of-factly. It gives all this extra spice and deliciousness through its use of language and image, and
it makes you have to slow down.
Yes.
Right. I mean, just like, you know, if you're in England and you order anything off of their menu, you can scarf it down and get the same flavor the whole time.
Yeah.
Right. But if you go to Italy or France, you're going to have to slow down a little bit, because the flavors that are in their food, as you were talking about earlier, it's so much more complex. And if you just scarf it down, it is to miss all those complex flavors. So it does require us to slow down. It does require a bit of discipline, but really just not letting us have to get through it and get on to something else.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's very important to read it slowly. You can skim a poem and say, I don't get this. I don't get what it's talking about. Well, of course you don't. You have to take up each word almost and really look at it. Not to say that this is something that's super hard to do, really. It's just, it takes time, and it's not as immediate as, you know, watching some TV show.
You're not going to be able to do it in just one reading.
Yeah.
You're going to have to go over it a number of times to really enjoy everything that is in it. It's like the difference between, again, the food analogy that you've made, the difference between swallowing something whole and actually taking time to chew it.
Right.
It's only by chewing and chewing slowly that we release all of those flavors. If we just swallow it whole, we might get the main point, but we're not going to get all of the extra goodness that is there.
Yeah, I think so. I think so too. You know, I think something that's kind of connected to this is also when you read poetry and you really take the time to explore the poem and kind of inwardly digest it, we might say. We should also be open and ready for the poem to influence us in some way, and maybe even challenge us, or that in examining a poem, we also are examining ourselves. As I said earlier, poetry often will surprise us by putting things in a way that we had never thought of before. And that's going to be difficult for people who aren't really interested in ever examining life and ever stopping and, you know, taking some time to just stop and think and wonder and contemplate what is this really all about? What is this experience all about, or this subject, whatever I happen to be thinking of? A poem helps us to do that, to kind of examine and aid us in some thoughtful consideration.
Yeah, and this is actually good advice also in our reading of the scriptures. There is a time to do big gulp reading, right?
Absolutely.
But there's also time to slow down and to ruminate is the term, you know, where we chew the cud of it. We really chew everything up and ponder it. And we need both of those things. We need to be able to do the big gulp to get the big picture, but we also need to really take a look at smaller bits and really chew all of the flavor out of those smaller bits. And that's the way it is with the scriptures, but then also with poetry. And poetry, since it tends to be shorter, unless you're talking about, you know, major works of poetry like the Divine Comedy or Shakespeare's plays or Milton's Paradise Lost, you're looking at typically smaller chunks.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Christians, we've been kind of talking about people in general, but I think Christians in particular should be open to poetry and have some room for it. You're going to have a hard time with a good deal of the Bible if you don't want to read any poetry at all. Also with, you know, we have, besides all of the hymns that we sing in church, but all of the Psalms, of course, a lot of the prophets, God inspired a lot of the Bible to be written in poetry. And I think that was on purpose to really bring something home a little bit more, to make it more obvious, to convey a deeper meaning that maybe just a straightforward sentence couldn't do. And this is also good for us to keep in mind when it comes to how we read the Bible. You know, even reading any part of the Bible, we should take some time to meditate on different parts of it, where we inwardly digest it. And I think poetry, particularly sacred Christian poetry, can be a great way to do that meditatio, the meditation on the scriptures, the inwardly digesting, the wrestling with the scriptures, whether you're the one writing a poem or you're the one reading the poem, it can be a good way to, or I guess poetry, Christian poetry can be a good exercise for the Christian in helping him or her meditate and ruminate on the scriptures themselves.
Well, I think beyond that, poetry teaches us to sing, kind of, right? I mean, it's meant to be, not sung to music per se, but poetry sings.
Yes.
And we sing about what we love.
Yeah.
So if we have nothing that we love, then we won't sing. And if we're not singing about what we love, man, that's just a really sad thing. And what I mean by love here, I mean things that we are willing to die for. I mean, that's what love is. That's what the Bible teaches us love is.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And so if we have nothing that we are willing to die for, and so we have nothing that we love, then of course we won't sing. But Christians have something we're willing to die for.
Right.
Right? And so we must be willing to sing, because otherwise we are living in two worlds. Right, we're saying that we have love, but we're unwilling to sing about it. That's not how love works. Love doesn't choose how it expresses itself. It will sing. It will talk about these things. It will, how does Peter put it? It will praise the excellencies of Him who called us out of darkness into His wonderful light. Yeah. So if we're not singing, if we don't have poetry in our lives, either biblical, Christian, you know, by some of these great Christian poets, we actually find that what we are creating is what C.S. Lewis describes in his Abolition of Man, men without chests, men who have nothing for which they are willing to die, nothing for which they can show courage or bravery or valor or victory.
Yeah.
And this is that's a really sad state. I think it's one of the things that poetry gets a bad name for is being effeminate, but it's just the opposite, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad that you brought that up. I think that's very general conception of poetry, not only among Christians, but just among the broader populace, that poetry is it's a girly thing, it's effeminate, and frankly, I think we should first admit and say, yeah, there is a lot of bad poetry out there, and some people can be very precious and picky and stuffy and hoity-toity about their poetry, and think a bit too highly of it and think too highly of themselves. But this is true in, it's not just poetry. This is true in all areas of life.
There are bad movies.
Yeah.
Right. I can think of Hallmark, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
There are bad hymns. Mm-hmm. There's bad music. There's bad of everything. And the bad of something should not make the good bad with it.
Right. And maybe... go ahead.
Yeah, it's that old saying, that the abuse of something or the misuse of something does not destroy its proper use.
Yes. I was going to say, maybe we should... explore just a little bit more when we say that sometimes it can be effeminate. What do we mean by that? We're not saying that femininity is bad, of course. This effeminate is softness when men don't act like men. And, the men without chests, as you said before. And you can be a very sort of what some might consider a very manly man. You're very strong. Your life is devoted to physical fitness, or your passion is some sport, and you can still be effeminate. You can still be incredibly shallow and soft. I think the real what's at the bottom of effeminacy is letting emotions rule us. Being interested in feelings for the sake of feelings. And that's the sentimentalism, the romanticism that, you kind of, I think of anyways, with what you said about the Hallmark movies, but also we can see in many, many bad poems. I think what's so wonderful about poetry and how it doesn't need to be effeminate. In fact, it really shouldn't be, is that there's a discipline to poetry, both in the writing of it and also in the reading of it. Just as we should discipline our emotions, we should put them under our control. So in poetry, the feelings that a poem evokes are important. The poem should be telling you how to feel about something, and the even the external discipline, the form of the poem itself, helps to master those emotions and control them and teach them. Poetry is often, most often, in some sort of meter. And so that's constraining. And it means that while you might want to capture some sort of emotion, you also need to choose just the right words to fit in the meter to also capture the emotion. And so clearness of thought, making proper distinctions, that is just as important as the beauty and the pleasantness that the emotions bring to it. And so I think in a poem, there's a sort of a neat marriage between the structure and then also the maybe more emotional side.
Yeah. Anthony Esalen talks about, well, he used to, when he would teach his students, he tells this story about he'd ask, you know, in the ancient world with German barbarians, you know, after they've come in from their fields harvesting and working hard and they're smelly and they're hungry and they're thirsty, and they come together as men, he said, you know, what things, he says this to his students, what things are there for this to take place, for these men to come together? And they all say food, and they all say beer. Mm-hmm. And then usually they say women. And he said, there are three, but that third one is not women. The third one is always poetry. That when they would get together, they would sing songs of the valor of those who have come before them, or of the victories that have been won on their behalf. I always found that really quite fascinating, that we have come to a time in the age of the world where this is no longer the case. At best, we'll get guys get together and have some kind of bad music, right?
Yeah.
Or bad poetry. But nothing that speaks of the past or the our forefathers and what they have done for us in a light that is good.
Yeah, you're right. I think C.S. Lewis was lamenting that as well. And when you brought up his work, The Abolition of Man, and I'm not sure I know what to say to give us some optimism about it, other than to promote it or
Part of it is just trying to restore it ourselves, right? I mean,
yeah.
Well, to learn it and then to teach it to others.
Yeah, absolutely.
So anything else on, you know, why poetry? Or can we get into the actual poems?
Yeah, I think we can start reading a few poems.
We are going to look at two poets today and a poem from each of them. We're going to look at the poet John Donne, and we're going to look at the poet George Herbert. We're going to do a little bit of background on each and then look at one of their poems each. So, Anthony, tell me a little bit about Donne.
All right. Well, first, maybe I should say about both of them. They're contemporaries. They come from the same era. And as we know, maybe from church history, there are certain times, I don't know what the explanation is for this, but there are just certain time periods where there is this time of giants, this time of masters. You know, we think of like the 3rd, 4th, 5th century era, especially maybe the 4th century Christian church with the giants of the early church. And Elizabethan England, Elizabeth's reign going into King James I, this was another one of those times, especially for the art of poetry. Everybody knows about William Shakespeare, right? This is his time. And then just a little bit younger than him, then are poets like John Donne and Ben Jonson and George Herbert, just a few that maybe some have heard of. But John Donne lived from 1572 to 1631, and he's an interesting figure from this time period. If you know anything about English history, you know that this is during and shortly after the English Reformation. It's been kind of back and forth for the last few monarchs, and Donne is from a Roman Catholic family, quite historic, actually. I think he's a distant relative of Thomas More, who was, killed by Henry VIII. Anyways, it was dangerous for Roman Catholics at this time to be living in England. Elizabeth was a Protestant queen, and many of Dunn's relatives are either arrested or exiled. And so some of his, you know, he wasn't really allowed to, or his family wasn't allowed to practice their faith quite in the open at that time. He studied the law early on as a young man. He began writing poetry as a young man, something that many, you know, young gentlemen would do. He has a very colorful past, and this is what makes Dunn quite famous, not only for Christians, but just for anyone who reads poetry. If you remember, you know, reading poetry in any of your high school English classes, I bet you read at least one by John Dunn. He's known for his love poems. One of his friends called him a great visitor of ladies. And I think that's probably the nicest way you could say that. But later in life, he did have a true conversion to the English Reformation. He became a very strong defender of the English Church, and, you know, kind of put his wild life behind him, of course. And in 1621, he even became the dean of St. Paul's Cathedral in London. That's just one step below a bishop, and he remained there the rest of his life. He was known as a great preacher, very eloquent, and also a great writer of sacred poetry. His poetry is very technical, and he's also an innovator in many ways, does some things that weren't quite the custom for his time, similar to Shakespeare in those ways, being kind of at the forefront of, breaking ground, I suppose. It can be quite complex and dense and does take a little, sifting through at times. Some people might know a couple of his most famous phrases, but they might not know exactly what they mean, what it really means. If you've ever heard somebody say, "Well, no man is an island," or if you've heard the phrase "For whom the bell tolls," those come from Dunn. They actually come from the same paragraph of one of his meditations on death. And maybe we won't go, we can save that for another time, but I just wanted to bring them up in case the name doesn't sound familiar. Many of his writings have had a lasting influence on our culture even today.
And what poem did you want to take a look at?
Yeah, I thought since we're coming up on Holy Week, we'll look at a poem by Dunn. Simply, we could say it's called Crucifying, but it's actually part of a longer work called La Corona, which means the crown. And the whole poem, the whole work, forms a circle, a crown. It's made up of seven sonnets. And the last line of one sonnet is the first line of the next, and then the last, and so on, you know. And then the last line of the very last sonnet is the first line of the very first sonnet. And so it makes a complete circle, a crown, or as Dunn calls it in the poem, a crown of prayer and praise that he offers to God. So I recommend, we're just going to read one section on it. It kind of covers the life of Jesus from the Annunciation to the Ascension. And I'd encourage anyone listening, they can look up La Corona to see the entire piece. Maybe we'll read some other sections of it someday. But for right now, we'll look at the part called Crucifying.
And I will find a link and put the link in the show notes for our listeners.
Great. Thank you. So should I go ahead and read this?
Yes, please.
All right. By miracles exceeding power of man, he, faith in some, envy in some begat. For what weak spirits admire, ambitious hate. In both affections many to him ran, but oh, the worst are most, they will and can, alas, and do unto the immaculate, whose creature fate is, now prescribe a fate, measuring self-life's infinity to a span, nay, to an inch. Lo, where, condemned, he bears his own cross with pain, yet by and by, when it bears him, he must bear more and die. Now thou art lifted up, draw me to thee, and at thy death, giving such liberal dole, moist with one drop of thy blood, my dry soul.
Those last three lines are magnificent.
Yes. Yeah, he captures references John 12, right? When the Son of Man is lifted up, I will draw all people to myself. Now thou art lifted up, draw me to thee, to Christ on the cross, and at thy death, giving such liberal dole, moist with one drop of thy blood, my dry soul.
Yeah, the image there is just so poignant in terms of us being withered, and yet he's the one dying.
Yeah.
And in his withering death, he is making moist and giving life to those who are withered.
Yeah, it's wonderful. That's there's a great paradox there, right? Which Lutherans often kind of revel in. And actually, Dunn is known for his paradoxes. It's often a key feature in many of his poems, is presenting the kind of paradoxical nature of things. Particularly, you know, look at where it says whose creature fate is, now prescribe a fate, measuring self-life's infinity to a span, nay, to an inch. So this is God, right? Jesus Christ, true God. One of his creatures, Dunn says, is fate. You know, the destiny of mankind is all, that's all under the power of God. And yet now here on the cross, God is prescribed a fate. He is condemned by his own creatures. The one who is the judge of all is judged. He is sentenced. And the one who is life itself, who is infinity, he is reduced to 33 years, right? He's cut off at that time. His life is ended. Even the infinite God is reduced to a measurable span. I think there you even have not only the measurable span of his life, but also the span of the dead man's arms stretched out and nailed to the cross. That's one paradox there. Another one just after it is where he says, lo, where condemned he bears his own cross with pain, yet by and by, when it bears him, he must bear more and die. Jesus bears his cross, right? He carries his cross, and yet at the same time, the cross must bear him. He's lifted up on the cross. And then there's more, even as Jesus is being born on the cross, being lifted on the cross, he is also bearing even more than that, much more than the weight that he bore when he carried the cross. He's bearing the sins of the world. He's bearing the wrath of God that's coming down upon him.
Yeah, that to go back to that first paradox you talked about, it's really stark, measuring self-life's infinity to a span, nay, to an inch. It makes you stop.
Yeah.
In the best possible way, it gives you pause.
Yeah.
Right. Even yeah, keep going.
Well, I was just going to point, this is a bit of a structural thing, but since we're talking about poetry, you can just notice this. If you look up the poem and read it for yourself, you'll see how the lines are set. Measuring self-life's infinity to a span is the end of the line. Nay, to an inch, period. Lo, where condemned he, end of next line. So normally we think of poems as, you know, the thought should end at the end of a line, but that doesn't always, sometimes poets will deliberately continue the thought to the next line. And here he does it and deliberately puts a period right in the middle of the line, you know, forcing you to stop.
Right.
Glad
right.
you brought attention to that.
Yeah, that is, it's masterful because as you're going through, you're exactly right. It forces you to stop. It, as I said, it gives you pause. You just, you stop and you have to take it in.
Yeah.
That he who is infinite comes into history and is measurable. It makes me think of, I think it's Bernard of Clairvaux, his sermons during Advent, where he talks about the one who is infinite becoming part of history, or the one who is omniscient now must learn, or, you know, all of these paradoxes of the fact that God became man. And he brings this out just wonderfully.
Yeah. Yeah. If any of our, you know, listeners enjoy these kinds of paradoxes, they're certainly evident here in this section of La Corona, but I also really encourage you to go read the Annunciation section and the Nativity section. The whole thing is great, but those two pick up what you're saying, what you're getting from Bernard of Clairvaux, that, you know, does all kinds of great paradoxes with the infinite God now coming into the finite. It's just here in this section with the death of Christ, it's, as you said, even more stark because he's not only become a man, but also a dead man. You can't get much more finite than that.
Right, exactly.
Well, I don't know if we have more on this one or if we should go to George Herbert.
Let's take up Herbert.
Okay. Well, I could tell you a little bit about George Herbert before we hear his poem. As I said, he's a contemporary of Donne, a little younger, also didn't live as long as Donne did, died as a younger man. He was even not only a contemporary, I should say, but he was a friend of Donne.
Oh,
they knew each other. In fact, I'm not as familiar with Herbert's life, but I believe Donne even preached a sermon for his mother's funeral. Acquainted. Anyways, George Herbert has a different background. He's from the nobility, maybe lower nobility, but nobility in England, Protestant family, I guess. And he served in Parliament for a little while. From what we can see of his life, he was quite different from Donne in his early years. He was a very, very pious man, as opposed to Donne running around with all the ladies. But George Herbert entered the ministry as a deacon first in 1624. This is in the Church of England. He was married about 5 years later. Yeah. And then in 1630, he was ordained a priest and he settled in a country parish. He even wrote a little book called The Country Parson about the pastor's life and duties. And if you find a volume, it's easy to find the complete works of George Herbert. There's not that many. In one, you can find it, and it'll all, that Country Parson volume will be included in the book with his poems. He suffered from poor health though for most of his life. And he died only 3 years after his ordination. He was only 39 years old. His poetry is a bit, I want to say it's a little more down to earth than a lot of John Donne's poetry. And not quite as complex and playing with all the kind of some of the metaphysical realities that Donne gets into. They're both good in their own way. Herbert, or I should say another reason why Donne is maybe more broadly known, you would probably read him in high school lit class rather than George Herbert, is that George Herbert wrote exclusively sacred poetry. Most of his poetry was published in a little volume after his death, called The Temple, which is where the one that we'll hear today comes from.
Yeah, the poem that we're going to hear from Herbert is called Sepulchre, and it's, as you mentioned, Anthony, from that greater work, The Temple. And he goes through a whole host of things in the temple, whether it's, there's this great one about Aaron. There's, you know, one about the Holy of Holies, and so all the things in the temple. And then there's this one on the sepulchre. I don't know much more about the organization of that particular work, the temple. Do you recall?
Yeah, not a lot, but it is organized at to kind of be going through the going through a church, as far as I know.
Okay.
I haven't read all of it and haven't spent as much time with it as I would like to, but it does have sort of the order of, you know, it begins in the like the vestibule kind of a thing, like a narthex sort of.
Yeah.
It starts with the church porch, I think, even outside the church. And then you enter and so you make your way through the church building in many respects, and it's not wooden in its structure, but it's got that kind of shape to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So here is Sepulchre by George Herbert. O blessed body, whither art thou thrown? No lodging for thee but a cold hard stone? So many hearts on earth, and yet not one receive thee? Sure, there is room within our hearts good store, for they can lodge transgressions by the score. Thousands of toys dwell there, yet out of door they leave thee. But that which shows them large shows them unfit. Whatever sin did this pure rock commit, which holds thee now, who hath indicted it of murder? Where our hard hearts have took up stones to brain thee, and missing this, most falsely did arraign thee, only these stones in quiet entertain thee and order. And as of old, the law by heavenly art was writ in stone, so thou, which also art the letter of the word, find'st no fit heart to hold thee. Yet do we still persist as we began, and so should perish, but that nothing can, though it be cold, hard, foul, from loving man withhold thee.
It's an excellent poem to hear, and Holy Week.
Well, yeah, it is. When I first read this, I wanted so badly to try to write a sermon around it, you know, either for Holy Saturday or sunrise service or something.
Yeah.
But to do it, you have to break the poem apart, and I just want them to hear the poem. You know?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
But I mean, it's instructive how he moves from the stone of the sepulcher, right? That he's in the church, and the sepulcher and the church is, you know, going to be underground, and he's looking at all of this stone, and he says, why is your body, your most holy body, here? Were there not any hearts on earth that could have received you that would have been better? Yeah. And he says, yeah, of course there is. There's lots of room
right.
in the hearts because they're full of transgressions.
Yeah.
And because they're full of transgressions, you are left out.
Right.
Right? That yeah. which shows them large shows them unfit.
Right. Yeah.
I like so he
calls them. He says thousands of toys dwell there. you know that it's just our hearts are full of just worthless things. Yet out of door they leave thee. So even it's captured wonderfully in the burial of Jesus, of course, that he's put into this. Tomb, but even, you know, earlier in the ministry of Jesus, that the Son of Man has no place to lay his head, right?
Right.
Or even at his birth, there's no room for them. They're put into
right, in the end.
He's put he's put into the manger, you know.
Yeah. So yeah, all of those scenes are kind of brought in, and the way that the sepulcher is of stone and it's cold and it's hard. Yet that thing which is cold and hard receives the Lord. And that which is supposedly alive and warm and pumping blood has no room for its own God. That it kind of brings to mind that the donkey knows its maker.
Yeah, yeah.
But you don't. Even the stone knows who I am.
Well, I was going to... It reminds me of what you said there about even the stone knows who I am made me think of in let's see the 10th line. He says, "Whatever sin did this pure rock commit?" Of course not. It doesn't sin. It does its creator's bidding. And the Bible verse that this reminds me of is how. The Pharisees say, "Tell your disciples to be quiet." And Jesus says, "If the disciples were silent, the stones would cry out."
Right. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. That. How does that go exactly? That even from these stones would they make sons of Abraham?
Oh, that's I think earlier.
Yeah.
But he also says it in Luke 19. Where that the stones would cry out in praise. I think it's in the
right.
Connection to the triumphal. Yeah, it's with the triumphal entry at the very end, as they're all singing, "Glory, you know, peace in heaven and glory in the highest, Hosanna, you know, blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord." It says some of the Pharisees in the crowd say to Jesus, "Teacher, rebuke your disciples." And he answers, "I tell you, if these were silent, the very stones would cry out." You know, that God is going to be worshipped. Every knee will bow. And so if sinful man won't own his creator, won't recognize him and make a place for him, then the stones will do it. You know, even if it means the stone tomb receiving the body of its Lord.
Yes. And as you said, this pure rock has committed no such sin. Who has indicted it of murder? In other words, it's we and our sins that have picked up rocks to stone him. We just heard this last week, right? When Jesus is in the temple precincts in John chapter 8.
Yeah.
Where our hard hearts have took up stones to brain thee.
Yeah, he's referencing that right there as the first attempt, and then missing this, most falsely did arraign thee, right? They finally, they win by false accusation, putting him on trial and getting him executed.
And then this second to the last stanza or verse, we have this, and as of old, the law by heavenly art was writ in stone. So this is the law given on Mount Sinai.
Yeah.
So thou, speaking of the Lord, which also art the letter of the word, John 1.
Right.
So just as the law, which was written on stone, found no heart to be held, so also now the word made flesh finds no heart in which to dwell. The law and the fulfillment of the law, both together, found no place to dwell in the heart of man.
Right.
That, I mean, that just so beautifully written and succinctly.
Yes.
I mean, you have to go through it a couple of times. You're like, yeah, that's right on.
Yeah. Yeah. And using the image of stone to connect those two things, right? That the
right.
law written in stone, now the word who should find his home in the hearts of man, but is rejected. So he is put into stone. The word made flesh is written into stone in his burial.
In his burial, yeah. Right. And this last part, yet do we still persist as we began, and so should perish. So we continue to find a means by which to keep the Lord out of our hearts, but that nothing can, though it be cold, hard, foul, from loving man withhold thee. So even though we persist, nothing can keep God in the flesh from loving us, though it be cold, hard, and foul, not just the stone of the sepulcher, because he rises again, but also our stone-cold hearts. He makes them new.
Yes.
It's just that last part, it just is gorgeous, really.
Yeah, it's isn't it wonderful gospel that answers, that just perfectly answers the law that he's been preaching, through the stone this whole time. And then just that last stanza, I mean, most of it is quite, condemning. And there you have the gospel promise that answers it all, that, what we might say it predominates.
I was just going to say that. Yeah. Would this pass the Walther Law gospel test and the gospel predominating? I think it does.
Yeah, I think so too. It's not a matter of percentage of words, but it is the law's accusation answered? Is it silenced? And as cold, hard, and foul as our stony hearts can be, nothing can withhold Christ from loving us, for he died for us.
Well, any final thoughts, Anthony, on the two poems or just on poetry in general?
Well, I suppose since it's this time of year, coming into in Holy Week and Easter, it's often very hectic for pastors and even for many lay people who have busy lives and also still, get into all those extra church services. I think poetry can be a nice little relaxing way to enjoy this season. There's just many good sacred poems on the suffering, death, and resurrection of Jesus. So I'd encourage people to look up some of those and let the poetry help them to kind of meditate and ruminate on what the death and resurrection of Jesus means.
And I'll get a list from you, Anthony, that we can also put in the show notes so that if people want to look at others, they can go and do that. How does that sound?
That sounds great.
Excellent. Well, it is, as you said, a perfect time of year to, even though it's busy, actually to slow down and make sure that we take in everything.
Yeah.
And contemplate it, ruminate over it, chew on it, so to speak. So thank you for your time, and thank you for helping us to slow down by looking at these two poets and these two glorious poems all about our Lord's suffering, death, and resurrection for the forgiveness of our sins. So thanks again for coming on, and I look forward to having you on again.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
All right, take care.
You too.